The time is 1:35. There are two present, myself and Senator Calgary. We will not have a quorum this morning, this afternoon. However, we will take public testimony on two bills. This is the first time that they would have been heard, and that's Senate Bill 76 and Senate Bill 62. We will first hear from Senate Bill 62. Would you state your name for the record?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, for the record. My name is Doug Letch. I'm an aide to Senator Gary Stevens. He had another commitment this afternoon, so he sent me along in his place. I do appreciate this chance to talk to you more about SB 62, which would set up the Advisory Committee on Public Reporting of Healthcare-Associated Infections, and that would fall within the Department of Health and Social Services. This bill comes out of the recommendations of the task force to assess public reporting of healthcare-associated infections, which met during the last interim. I had three meetings. The most recent one was here in Juneau, right the day before session. And their job was to study the unique challenges that face Alaska with regard to reporting of healthcare-acquired infections and tracking those. So this is what's come out of that. The group felt that it was appropriate to move on with a much bigger, broader scope than what they were able to do in the course of 3 minutes. So they've recommended that this advisory committee be formed. And what the goal would be is to put a member of the Senate, appointed by the Senate President, a member of the House, appointed by the Speaker, and nine members appointed by the Governor, as well as a state official in charge of epidemiology. The nine members appointed by the Governor would include a couple of physicians, two with experience in the area of infectious diseases, a representative of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, which runs hospitals here in Alaska, a representative of the Alaska chapter of the Association of Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology, a representative of the State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, and a couple of consumers, one from urban Alaska and one from rural Alaska, and a statistician, somebody who can keep track of various statistical information that comes in. Over the coming years, the committee's role is going to be to develop recommendations for collecting, analyzing, and distributing information related to this healthcare associated infections area. And by January of 2009, the committee will provide recommendations to the department for setting up a pilot program for reporting of healthcare associated infections. And by January of 2011, they'd provide the legislature with a report addressing the unique challenges that we face as a state, which, as you know, are quite diverse as is Alaska. We've got big hospitals and small hospitals, so there are a lot of challenges. And they'll also come up with recommendations for ongoing reporting. We've got a lot of information on this. Some of it's been included in your packets. It's an ongoing work. A lot of states are doing this type of reporting, and we've learned a little bit from them over the course of studying this issue in the past year or so. It's also a letter of support we received just today from AARP Alaska. Mm-hmm. And we've got some folks online, I believe, Dr. Jay Butler, who at the time was the epidemiologist working with us on the task force and is now the director of the Division of Public Health. And I believe a few of the task force members may be online. I know Kim Mine Spinks, who was on our task force, is available. As for you, Madam Chair,
yes.
The task force. So I'd be happy to entertain any questions you may have. Some of the more detailed information, I think I'd probably be better answered by Dr. Butler if he's available.
Yes, thank you very much. Dr. Butler is on the phone to speak to this.
Yes, ma'am, I am here. Sorry I couldn't be with you today.
Well, you could have got into Juneau anyway, so you're lucky you're there.
But thank you for being online, and we'll hear from you at this time. You want to state your name for the record?
My name is Jay Butler, Director of the Division of Public Health, Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
You may continue.
Okay. I think Mr. Letch should provide a a nice overview of how we've approached this issue of infections in healthcare settings. Historically, public health and healthcare settings, which also traditionally have meant hospitals, have not had a lot of overlap. However, changes in how we provide healthcare have highlighted the need for public health attention to issues that go on in hospitals. Probably the most important is that much of what we would consider or would have considered 20 years ago fairly intensive healthcare intervention is now done on an outpatient basis and in the community. Or, as a colleague once put it, we now send people home who are sicker than the ones we used to admit to the hospital. This has led to a consumer-driven interest in public disclosures of hospital rates of infection within healthcare settings, particularly within hospitals. It's estimated that there are as many as 2 million cases of infection that are associated with healthcare settings each year in the United States. The economic impact of those infections estimates vary widely, but generally range from $4 to $6 billion in excess healthcare costs. Additionally, the estimates of the impact on mortality or the number of deaths associated with these infections are somewhat varying also, but most range around 90,000 each year. A number of states have moved forward with requiring public disclosure of hospital-specific infection rates. However, there's a number of challenges to this approach, and these are things that the working group that was established under SJR 19 spent a good bit of time discussing, and I'd like to summarize those now because I think that helps to account for why we have now a new bill before you. The challenges include some of the difficulties with hospital-based surveillance and epidemiology, and it can be difficult to accurately identify infections and to determine that they are indeed associated with healthcare. Additionally, as I mentioned earlier, how we deliver healthcare has changed radically over the past 10 to 20 years, and oftentimes these infections don't actually develop until after a patient has gone home. There are also problems, challenges for the hospitals. Identifying these infections can be a disincentive if indeed those rates of infection will then publicly disclosed, and potentially one of the downsides of this is that the hospital is doing the best job identifying, treating, and reporting infections will appear to have the highest rates, while those who are not as fastidious may not may actually appear safer. Additionally, no hospital is the same as another, and patients, the types of patients seen in various hospitals may differ. Certain hospitals take care of higher risk patients, so simple numbers can be very difficult to interpret. And indeed, numbers can be misleading. For instance, if we're talking about just disclosure of the number of infections, that can truly be misleading. If, say, Hospital A has 10 of 1,000 admissions have infections, Hospital B has 20 of 5,000, just the numbers 10 and 20 might make it appear that B has twice the number of infections, where in fact it has half the rate of infections because Hospital B takes care of so many more patients. A special challenge for us here in Alaska is the relatively small numbers of patients that we have. Having a small population, only 5 hospitals, I believe, with more than 50 beds, it can be difficult to report data that are useful. And finally, and the challenge that I think we grappled with the most is while there's good scientific evidence that infection control practices can prevent infections, to date, there's no evidence that public reporting will actually improve health. Let me also say that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Hospital Infection Practices Advisory Committee, which includes a number of external experts to the CDC, has published a position paper on this topic. The group did not recommend for or against mandatory reporting, but rather felt that as of yet it has potential to improve hospital infection control practices, but it's not yet proven. However, they did specify certain criteria that states may wish to follow in requiring reporting. One was to use established public health surveillance methods, namely reporting through health agencies that do public health surveillance. Second, to use a multidisciplinary advisory panel to be able to guide states that are venturing into this area. And that's really the meat of SB 62. The only difference is we are asking this advisory committee to advise us in terms of just what type of surveillance to do, because there are so many unknowns in this area. The third recommendation was to choose appropriate process and outcome measures, process being what a hospital does, outcome being what it means for patient health. There were three specific process measures and two specific outcome measures. The measures were related to placement of central venous catheters. These are the big IVs that go into major vessels, oftentimes under the collarbone, to collect information on how those are inserted, because there's very good evidence that insertion practices can influence infection rates, and then also the outcome measure of infection rates. Secondly, to be doing surveillance for surgical site infections, that is, infections that occur in areas that where surgery has been performed, and also the process measure of whether or not preventive antibiotics were administered at the appropriate time, that is usually within 1 hour of the insertion of the incision. And finally, one more outcome measure was the rate of influenza vaccination among healthcare workers at the institution. The fourth recommendation of the CDC was that the agency collecting these data provide regular and confidential feedback to healthcare providers. I think, as I mentioned a little earlier, 16 states have passed some type of law requiring public reporting of infection rates. These laws really vary widely. Two of the states actually only require reporting to public health agencies and do not provide for public disclosures. There is also two additional states that have passed laws requiring hospitals to report infection information, which is a fairly vague term, and basically is asking the hospitals to make some sort of statement to the public to provide reassurance that those institutions are doing everything they can to prevent hospital-acquired infections. That's a bit of a whirlwind tour. I hope that's an adequate encapsulation of what the working group from SGR 19 achieved during the three meetings we had over the past several months, and I would be happy to take your questions.
First, I'd like to say we appreciate all the work that you did with the working group, and we're looking forward to forming this task force so they can continue the work that's been started. Is there anyone in the audience that need to testify to 62? We do have some other people online. Are there any questions for Dr. Butler?
I'm not exactly a question, but I haven't experienced something that this is. I was in the hospital last summer more than I've ever been in my life, and while I was there, I developed cellulitis in my right leg, and the doctor prescribed a salve sort of thing to put on, so every 4 hours or 5 hours, whenever the nurse would come in and apply the salve to my leg. One night, a nurse came in, and this salve came in like a toothpaste thing, you know, but there was two. I had another salve that was for another purpose. The nurse came in, and all the time the nurses would come in, they'd put on the rubber gloves and apply the salve. This nurse came in, and no rubber gloves, and not only that, she applied the wrong salve to my leg. I mentioned that to her, and she argued that this was the right salve, but in my weakened condition, I didn't argue with her because she was a pretty good-sized nurse. But anyway, I reported this to the executive director of the hospital because I thought, you know, I had cellulitis. That's a skin infection, what that's basically. And I had the nurse's name and everything. And I think there's a lot of good nurses in the hospital. There's a few that don't do it right. And I think hopefully we pass this and there'll be more attention paid for those guidelines of how they should do things.
All right, thank you. We also have Sandra Stark. Are you online?
Yes, this is Sandra Stark in Homer.
Yes.
I'm a public member of the initial working group, but I'm just testifying for myself here. And Senator Davis,
yes.
Members of the Senate Health, Education, and Social Services Committee, I want to thank you for holding this hearing and considering this legislation, for lives will be saved. It's estimated nationally that 5 million incidents of medical harm over the next 2 years alone could be prevented with the safeguards in place. How many in Alaska? We don't know, for we have yet to track areas of possible improvement. Through monitoring, there is encouragement of adoption of the best practices in healthcare facilities, such as hospitals and surgery centers. These practices range from hand washing to using commercial securing devices for catheters and providing and educating patients and visitors of the risks and responsibilities when in a healthcare facility. Environmental cleanliness, patient screening, and isolation procedures where appropriate do make a difference. What is monitored improves. By allowing a pilot program, we'll know by how much and what works best for us in Alaska. Less infection means less hospitalization, means less costs, means lower taxes and premiums for health care. Our costs in Alaska are legendary. For instance, on the southern half of the Kenai Peninsula, our unreimbursed costs of Medicare, Medicaid, and charity care for self-pay patients at the local hospital have helped create a deficit in the 2007 income statement of the last 7 months of $1.9 million, which impacts local property tax and can affect hospital bond elections, where taxpayers help support our hospital. The prevention of problems is the fastest way to cut medical costs. Please enable passing SB 62. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'd also like to thank you for your work on the working committee and for your testimony also. We also have two other people that are signed up for 62. Is Rosemary Craig here?
Yes, I am.
Okay. You're online. You may testify.
Yes, I am also in support of the bill, and I have worked with Ms. Stark in the Lower Kenai Peninsula. It would be advantageous for the entire state to do some to have some type of tracking, but it is a concern, especially how smaller hospitals would be compared to larger hospitals, and that would be something that I request that the committee investigate further as far as actual comparison data. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We also have Jennifer Grog, Alaska Hospital Nursing Association, Home Association. Could you get closer to the microphone?
Is that better?
Yes, that's some better.
Okay. My name is Jennifer Grog. I'm a registered nurse, and I'm representing ASHNA, who is the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. It's a membership of 24 acute care hospitals.
Excuse me?
Yes, ma'am.
There's background noise. Are you in You're home with the radio or something on?
No, I'm in my office with the door closed and no other things are on.
All right, let's try it again.
Okay. My name is Jennifer Grock. I'm a registered nurse and I'm representing ASHNA, the Alaska State Home and Nursing Home Association. Membership includes 24 acute care hospitals, 2 behavioral health facilities, 6 assisted living facilities, and 5 freestanding nursing facilities. 9 of the 24 acute care hospitals also provide nursing home services. ASHNA's position on SB 62 urges a cautious approach and supports the establishment of an advisory committee on public reporting of healthcare-associated infections related to reporting and dissemination of data concerning healthcare-associated infections. The advisory... Hello?
We hear you.
Where are you?
Okay. The advisory committee would be able to review the status and success of states with similar legislation on the issue of mandatory reporting of healthcare-associated infections. Many states have yet to implement these regulations because of the difficulty in creating equitable guidelines for all reporting agencies. This important issue should be designed with the nuances of Alaska in mind, and there is little room for cookie-cutter legislation. Alaskans do not have a wide variety of choices in their selection of healthcare facilities, and we need to be certain that Alaskans understand that the goal is to create the safest healthcare environment possible for all Alaskans. With more procedures and surgeries being performed in ambulatory or same-day surgery facilities, these organizations should be included in the reporting process to give a broad base of information. The members of the advisory committee will require background knowledge and information to establish a foundation of mutually agreed upon definitions of infections that all healthcare facilities in the state of Alaska will adhere to when reporting on healthcare associated infections. This common base of definitions and terms will allow for the equitable formulation of reporting and maintain the confidentiality of patients who are being served in these facilities. ASHNA encourages the legislation go forward with SB 62.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you for the opportunity.
We also have Kim Mimes speak.
Hello there, good afternoon. My name is Kim Mimes speak, and I represent the Midnight Sun chapter of the Infection Control Professionals and Epidemiology. We have about 27 members here in the state of Alaska, and there are about 11,000 members nationally and internationally. And for the Midnight Sun group here in Alaska, we do support SB 62. I think that Dr. Butler and both Doug Letch have done a marvelous job of summarizing the work that has gone into the review of this. And we support it, and would be happy to stay on the task force, the advisory group, and continue to work to ensure that there is clear definitions, equitable reporting, that we pilot something that is very useful both to the hospitals and the consumers of healthcare.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and glad to hear you say that you're willing to probably serve on this committee, this task force, once it's established. We'll be sure to pass that along. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any persons in the audience that want to testify? Is there anyone else online that I have not called? Are here no other people at this time? I'll close public testimony on this bill. It was not my intention to move it out of the committee today. We will bring it back at a later date. We will let you know when that's going to take place. We'll close testimony at this time. We also have another bill to come before us. Senate Bill 76. The sponsors come forward, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and member of the committee. For the record, I'm Johnny Ellis, representing Senate District L, downtown and midtown Anchorage, and I really appreciate you having the bill before you today.
Thank you very much.
And for your co-sponsorship, Madam Chair, of the legislation. I know many of us in the legislature have worried about children who are in out-of-home placements, foster kids in the state of Alaska. What happens to them once they age out of the system at the age of 18? There have been some studies done, and the statistics aren't good about the outcomes for those children in continuing their education and in becoming productive citizens, in spite of the best intentions of foster parents out there. And so I racked my brain and thought, what can we do at a time when we're trying not to create new programs, when we're trying to control costs, at a time when we're trying to get private money and the faith-based community and the charitable community involved in helping out people that that government may not have all the resources to help. So I was looking for a collaborative approach of the public and private sectors. And what I decided to do was to propose here in the state of Alaska what they do in my home state of, in Senator Cowdery's home state of Missouri. They have a Believe program that deals with education savings accounts for kids aging out of foster care. And so with Senate Bill 76, we're proposing such an approach here in the state of Alaska called ASPIRE, which is an acronym for Alaska's Youth Succeed When People Invest Resources in Education. And what the bill proposes to do is to establish this program in statute and to allow churches, individuals, charities, community organizations to open in the name of kids in out-of-home placements in the state of Alaska, and there are hundreds and hundreds of them, Madam Chair, all across the state, to allow those private sector folks to set up college savings accounts, education savings accounts through the award-winning 529 college savings account through the University of Alaska. Many of you know that that's an excellent program. It's managed by T. Rowe Price, a private sector firm. It has a great track record, and that the donations to those 529 savings accounts can be used for any kind of education endeavor that the child or that the young adult wants to pursue after they're out of state custody, whether that means going on to the university or going to a community college elsewhere or going to welding school or becoming a cosmetologist. It's a very loose program for qualified education expenditures. And so we'd be establishing in the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives a system for Office of Children's Services to share confidential information about these children, many of whom have had just very, very difficult childhoods, many who have suffered from abuse and neglect. And so these are kids that are essentially, we used to call them wards of the state in the old days. They're kids in out-of-home placements that would not otherwise be able to go on and pursue their educational endeavors. Right. We can't expect foster parents or grandparents who may be taking care of these kids to save for college, as expensive as that is today, or to save for Voc Tech school. That's more affordable, but still expensive. And so this is a unique way to bring together the resources of the public and private sector to help these kids achieve their educational goals and hopefully become more productive and independent citizens as time goes on. So that's the broad outline, Madam Chair. I commend it to you. I think it's something that we can promote across the state, and I really expect the churches and private individuals and the Elks and the Kiwanis and the Rotary and lots of folks to consider donating to these education savings accounts to help these kids in the future. So with that, Madam Chair, I have a staffer here, Gabe Aceves, who's an expert on the legislation. And I know we have several folks online who can speak to the bill as well.
You do.
Thanks again for having it before you today.
Thank you very much, and I am very supportive of this bill. It was introduced last year. I was hoping that it would come back again, and it did, and I thank you. This is just one of the many steps that we need to take towards doing things to help children that are aged out of foster care. I think this can be very successful, and I'm looking forward to passing this bill so that our youngsters can use it.
Thank you.
We do have online Mike Lesbenman, Child Services. Leesman or Lesman?
It's Lesman.
Lesman.
I'm here, Madam Chair.
Yes, would you like to do your testimony at this point?
Sure.
Would you state your name for the record?
Yes, thank you. Children's Services as their Community Relations Manager here in Juneau.
Okay.
Good afternoon. I'll make this very brief. I'm calling from a snowbank in the Mendenhall Valley here.
Wow. Okay.
And unfortunately, I don't have my bill file with me at the house, and if the committee members have specific questions about numbers and data and stuff like that, I'm sure I can get them to the committee tomorrow.
All right, thank you.
But generally speaking, madam, the Office of Children's Services and the Division of Juvenile Justice has worked with Senator Ellis and his staff on the bill, and we're very supportive of Senate Bill 76. The Faith-Based and Community Initiatives Office of the Department of Health and Social Services is also a partner in this endeavor, and this bill will allow OCS and DJJ to work with the Faith-Based and Community Initiatives Office to provide information to the university about kids that have been in custody and placed in out-of-home care. We look forward to developing the procedures necessary to share information with the university and direct the donors' monies to the beneficiaries of these children that have been in state's custody. I'm happy to answer any questions if members or yourself, Madam Chair, have any for me.
I think I have one question from Senator Calgary at this point.
Yeah, I don't know if this is appropriate to the sponsor or yourself. What happens to the money if the foster child doesn't use it? In other words, where does it go?
I can answer that. For the record, my name is Gabe Aceves. I am staff to Senator Ellis. With the UA College Savings Plan, the accounts are extremely flexible in that if there is a child, a beneficiary that's named, and it turns out later, for whatever reason, the child isn't able to use that money, the beneficiary name can be changed. So if there were a sponsor who donated money to an account for a child, and for whatever reason that child wasn't able to use the money, they would be able to get in touch with the Office of Faith-Based Community Initiatives, or OCS, and they would be able to change the beneficiary name on that account. So if there was a group or a business or a church that wanted to help a child out, and it turns out that child isn't eligible for whatever reason, they can always change the name of the beneficiary.
Very good. Thank you very much. Any other questions? We do have some other testimonies. Is Terry Harton online?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
You may speak at this point.
Thank you. Greetings to you, Senator Davis and Calgary. And thanks for the opportunity to testify as well as represent the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. We are supporting Senate Bill 76. For the record, my name is Tara Horton, and I am the Associate Coordinator of the Office of FBCI. As a social worker, I am keenly aware of the challenges facing our youth in out-of-home care. Prior to my position with the Office of FBCI, I spent time at OCS in a permanency unit with Covenant House in their transitional living program, as well as at South Central Foundation in a similar transitional program, specifically catering to Alaska Native youth involved in the child protection system. During my graduate studies, including postgraduate research and evaluation, I did focus much of my attention and research on foster care and the development of the independent living program. So this is near and dear to my heart. What we do know to be true for these youth is that aside from their lives being turned upside down and having no choice but to spend a significant portion of their time in, yes, a positive but at times flawed foster care system, many would likely describe their formative years as both chaotic and inconsistent. Research tells us that youth aging out of foster care are at higher risk of experiencing unemployment, homelessness, financial hardship, poor physical health, substance abuse, criminal behavior, and low educational achievement than their counterparts that are, may not have been involved in the child welfare system. Although many youth in care aspire to pursue educational education beyond high school, few are actually able to do so. While a number start out to pursue this goal, few complete a degree or certificate. And in a national independent living study, a vast majority, about 75% of these young people cited finances as the major deterrent to further education. Simply put, a program like Aspire that is proposed in Senate Bill 76 would address this challenge faced by youth who have spent a significant amount of time in out-of-home care. It would not only enable the proverbial village, that is businesses, churches, civic groups, nonprofits, and individual citizens to invest in and care for the futures and success of our youth, but it would provide these young people with a much-needed tool to pursue their dreams and live successful, productive, and self-sufficient lives, and hopefully lives that might one day be able to give back to this great state. So I thank you for your time and consideration of supporting this bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I could.
Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to say to Ms. Horton, thank you very, very much for your wonderful testimony and for your help with the acronym and the logo. We have it on buttons here with the committee and on the packets, and it's wonderful, and we really appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. Glad to be a part of it.
All right. We also have two people that are signed here together, Linda English and Jim Lynch. Are you testifying together?
Yes, we will. This is Jim Lynch. I apologize.
All right.
I did call in to testify for Senate Bill 76. I think I met with the committee last year on this bill. The university does support the bill, and we did participate in some of the drafting of it to see that it works in unison with the college savings program. I also feel that the program is aptly named, the Aspire. I was really impressed with the name because in many respects, that's one of the things that we were trying to accomplish when we created the program. And I will admit, I was not thinking of foster youth at the time, but it was really how to help those that, in that case, how to help those that could help themselves. And the importance of the having money in a college savings account is not always the financing of education. In many respects, what you're really doing is trying to change that aspiration or create the aspiration of going to college or at least whatever they're going to do to set their goals. And these programs don't have to be used for college. They can be used for vocational education or any technical education, in fact. So. I think it's an outstanding program. I don't think that I have trouble seeing how people would be harmed at all by this program. I think it's even if they don't ever get to college, if it's changed their perspective on life when they were in sixth grade, it's accomplished a goal. And that money can be reprogrammed for another beneficiary and do its job over again. It will be invested during this period and will continue to grow. If anybody has any questions, we'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. Is there any? Yes. Senator Ellis would like to speak.
Madam Chair, thank you. This is the point where someone always brags on Jim Lynch and the program there at the University of Alaska that he's created. He's the real expert. He helped us with the drafting to make sure nothing we were doing in our proposed legislation complicated in any way the university's award-winning program. So thank you, Jim. And I think it was Gary Wilkin last year, and I'll do it this year, that bragged on you and your shop there for the good work that you do.
Yes, we'll take our public testimony at this point.
Linda indicated that she doesn't have any further comments at this time.
All right, thank you very much. We'll come back to the sponsor of this bill, Senator Ellis. Why don't you go back over it once more time? I know I'm a co-sponsor of this bill, and I support it very, very much, but I want you to tell me exactly what the age timelines would be for youngsters to use the money that might be set up in an account for them.
Okay. Madam Chair, if you don't mind, I'm going to let my staffer help me out with that.
Sure. I'm not sure exactly what you're asking. I do know that one of the provisions in the bill and one of the standards already set by OCS is that kids in long-term out-of-state care are the most eligible. So those are the kids that we included in this bill, and those are kids who have been in out-of-home placement for 2 years or more. So that's the minimum standard. We have left it up to the department to establish the specific criteria for who is the most eligible as we get donors to pledge money to these accounts. And from what I understand, and Mike Lessman might be able to answer this a little better, from what I understand, their two most important criteria when considering children for options like these are the age of the child, because it's important to take care of those kids who are aging out first, and the length of stay in out-of-home care. And so I think those are the two biggest factors when they try and determine who is the most eligible for these benefits.
That sort of hit upon what I was asking in the question. Now, when they're aged out at age 19, would they still be eligible for the funds to be used? Say they go off to college, and it's usually going to take that youngster longer than a four-year period to finish school. And so forth, they might run into age 23 or whatever. Would they still be eligible to receive the money from the plan if there was money there?
Yes, Madam Chair. The benefits, the way I understand, through the UA College Savings Program are good until a beneficiary reaches the age of 30. And I think Jim Lynch could answer that better. But I believe 30 is the age limit for the UA College Savings Program.
Would you like to speak to that, Mr. Lynch? Maybe he's already off.
He was on mute.
In
my opinion, should be adequate. It, you need some trigger point at which you decide that that money should go to someone else. That's at least my personal view on it. There is no practical limitation within the college savings program itself.
All right, thank you.
Sure, even I could save for my education.
All right, thanks. Is there anything else that you'd like to say that's unique about the program that it hasn't come out yet in this hearing?
We have none here at the university.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry. I was talking to the sponsors at this time.
No, I think we've covered it pretty well.
All right, thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience that want to testify to the bill? All right, would you come forward, please? Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chairman, Senator Cowdery, my name is Chip Wagoner. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Conference of Catholic Bishops, the official public policy arm of the church in Alaska. We support Senate Bill 76. We commend the sponsor for thinking of this bill last year and thinking of foster care children who are often lost in the system. We also thank the chairman for co-sponsoring the bill. We have appeared before various committees of the legislature many times advocating on behalf of various government programs such as Denali Kid Care, the Senior Care Program, the Adult Dental Care. This bill is slightly different, and we support it all the more because government cannot do everything, and our faith calls on each of us as individuals to take some of the bounty that we have been given by our Lord and to give it to others who are in need, particularly in this time of Lent where there is a time for prayer, a time for fasting, and a time for almsgiving. We think this is a very appropriate bill to be introduced at this period in time. The bill will provide a needed step up for those who will need it at a very critical time in their life when they are aging out of the system, the foster care system at age 19. I was not a foster care student myself, but I remember when I graduated from high school, I had my savings from working through high school, and I had a little bit of scholarship funds, not much, but some. That was what enabled me to pay for my first year of college. But for that, I might not have been able to make it through my first year of college. This program will give other people the opportunity to do what I had the privilege of doing, attending the University of Alaska. We are fully in support of this program, and we particularly like the aspect of it that calls for marketing of the program, because that's going to be an essential component for the program's success, is that for people to know about it. I can envision parishes, for example, wanting to adopt a scholarship student and paying for their scholarships throughout their time in college or technical school or vocational school. I can see individuals wanting to do the same thing, and maybe even corporations or other nonprofits. We think this is a great idea. We fully support it. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I hadn't thought in terms of length and Thanksgiving, Easter coming up and all, but we are known in Alaska as people that like to give, support others, and I think this is going to be a great program. It, as you said, marketing is most important because we have to get the word out so people will know that it's there in order to give the money. If there's no further testimony at this time, we will close testimony on the bill. We will bring the bill back at a later time. We will take public testimony again on the next hearing, and I hope that we'll be able to pass the bill out at that time. Thank you very much. If there's no one else to say anything about this bill, we're actually done with HESS for the day. We'll close at this time about 20 minutes after 2.
Thank you.